Chance to just read through the book of James before tonight. One hand. All right, well, get two hands. Guess what your assignment is for Sunday morning? Read through the book all the way through. We want to introduce ourselves to this epistle of James. It really is a unique book in the New Testament. I made the statement that I think it does kind of naturally follow to study this book from our study of Proverbs and the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. And the reason why I think that's so is because James has oftentimes been called the wisdom literature of the New Testament. It's very Jewish in the way that it's written and in this whole idea of just kind of Not Proverbs, but at least short discussions on various topics. Just kind of going from one topic to another throughout the book. And that's very much like what you see, say, in the book of Proverbs or Ecclesiastes. And I think you'll see that the style of writing is very much like the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. But the book of James is written to Christians and talking about very, very practical things in reference to their Christian life. And I think it's just a tremendously valuable epistle for us. When you just look at this epistle, it starts out, James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. Greetings. So that's how James begins this letter. The obvious question we need to deal with first is, who is this James that is being talked about here? Who was the James who's the author of this letter? And I want to just real quickly go through some possibilities that people have raised, and I think the answer to who this James is very clear, but some people have said that, well, maybe it's James, the son of Zebedee. Remember James and John, the two sons of Zebedee who were so close with Jesus as his apostles during Jesus' ministry. But that really doesn't make a lot of sense. He died very early, according to Acts chapter 12. And even though I think this epistle of James may very well be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, of the New Testament books to be written, still, I don't think that it would be dated that early. So there are not many people who think that James, the son of Zebedee, is the author. There's another James who was another one of the 12 apostles, James, the son of Alphaeus, and probably connected with James the Less, according to Mark 15:40. This is one of those 12 apostles that you just don't know very much about. He's kind of a minor figure, though he certainly was an apostle. Some Roman Catholics especially have argued that this must be the James of the epistle, rather than the third possibility that we haven't got to yet, James the Lord's brother. Anybody know why it is that a lot of Roman Catholics have especially wanted to argue that it was James, the son of Alphaeus, and not James, the brother of Jesus? Anybody have a thought on that? Yeah, it really runs counter to the Catholic doctrine of the perpetual virginity of Mary. If Mary and Joseph had other children after Mary gave birth to Jesus. If Mary and Joseph had other children, then that would, of course, argue that Mary did not continue to be a virgin. And certainly one traditional Catholic doctrine is that Mary remained a virgin even after she gave birth to Jesus. The New Testament does not support that, never teaches that, but that is certainly one of the reasons why, especially Roman Catholics, have sometimes argued, not always argued, but sometimes argued that maybe the James here is James, the son of Alphaeus. But that really isn't the likely James here. I don't think there's much question that the James who's the author of this epistle is James, the brother of the Lord. He is one of the brothers of Jesus who did not believe in Jesus early on, but who after Jesus' resurrection not only became a believer in Jesus, but became a leader in the Jerusalem church, Acts 12:17, and various other passages in Acts that we're going to look at more in just a second. speak of James, the brother of Jesus, being a very, very key figure and being a leader in that Jerusalem church. And in fact, he's such a prominent figure that throughout the rest of Acts and even in Paul's epistles, he's just referred to as James. And everybody knows who that James is. So after James, the son of Zebedee, dies in Acts 12, that there really is one James who is so prominent among the early Christians that he's just able to be identified simply as James, nothing else. And everybody knows who he is. And I think that's who the author of this epistle is. And even some Roman Catholics are willing to acknowledge that even early church tradition was pretty much unanimous in understanding this was the James who wrote this letter. Does anybody know what, since I brought up the Roman Catholic view and the perpetual virginity of Mary view, does anybody know how they might still be willing to accept that this is written by James, the brother of Jesus, and yet still hold to the perpetual virginity of Mary doctrine? Tony? Yeah, the Synoptic Gospels just list the brothers of Jesus. And there's a couple of ways that it is suggested that that could be understood. One is that maybe those brothers of Jesus are Joseph's children by an earlier marriage. Okay? That the term brother is being used in a very loose sense. Kinsmen, so they might have been cousins, say, not actually the children of Joseph and Mary. That has been a common speculation to still be able to hold to the perpetual virginity of Mary doctrine. But, that's really not the natural way to read the text. There's no hint that Joseph had been married previously or whatever, you know. Most people don't really have much problem acknowledging that James, the brother of Jesus, is the James that's being referred to here. In fact, we mentioned the family of Jesus in such passages as Matthew 13, verse 55. You've got the various siblings of Jesus who are mentioned there. James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas, or Jude, as it would sometimes be rendered. And I don't think there's any question that this is the James who's the author of this epistle. And I think, as I said earlier, it's important for us to appreciate some of the history of this James. I think it's a very interesting trek that he makes. He and his brothers, originally not believing that their brother Jesus was the Messiah. In John chapter 7, verses 2 through 9, in fact, we saw this in our Gospel of John study, where there's the account of the feast and the brothers of Jesus in sort of a condescending way are urging Jesus to go up to the feast if he thinks that he's this prophet of God or this great Messiah figure or whatever. Why don't you go up to the feast? And Jesus says, I'm not going to go up with you to this feast, but then he later goes up secretly. And verse 5 says, not even his brothers were believing in him. And so this is what was true of James and Joseph and Simon and Jude, the brothers of Jesus. Early on, they were not accepting Jesus as the Messiah. But after Jesus' resurrection, he appeared to James. This is what Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 6 and following, when he's giving the list of post-resurrection appearances. He says among those appearances that Jesus appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. So he's talking about the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus up in Galilee, and Jesus appeared to 500 brethren at one time, and after that he appeared to James. And I think it's very clear what who the James is Paul is referring to, that leader in the Jerusalem church, James, the half-brother of Jesus. And in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1 and verse 14, again, this is after Jesus has been resurrected, and has appeared to James. And now you see that James and his brothers, they are believers in Jesus. Now they are following Jesus, and they're aligning themselves with the disciples. The apostles with one mind were continually devoting themselves to prayer along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. So it's after the resurrection of Jesus that James becomes a believer. So in many ways, it's a very similar kind of transition that we see with Paul, where it's the resurrection of Jesus that convinces James, just like he convinced Paul, that he really was the Messiah. And so after that, James becomes a real leader there among the Jewish Christians. And this is what you see when you look at the book of Acts. And I'm just going to quickly go through some of this. In Acts 12, you've got the account of James, the son of Zebedee, being executed by Herod, and Peter being thrown in prison. But you remember in Acts 12 that the Lord miraculously delivers Peter from prison. And there's this very interesting statement. Peter says to report these things to James and the brethren. So even at this stage, James is a key leader. Report these things to James and the brethren. In Galatians 2 and verse 9, when Paul is writing to the Galatian Christians about his very few trips to Jerusalem, but on this one occasion when he came to that city, it says that he met with James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars. And so in the context, very clear, that's James, the Lord's brother, and Peter and John. So you see this very prominent position that James now has, just aligned right there with the 12 apostles. You see this again in Galatians 1, verse 18 and 19, when Paul talks about the first time he had come up to the city after he became a Christian. He says, I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas and stayed with him 15 days, but I did not see any other of the apostles except James, the Lord's brother. Now that's an interesting statement. I did not see any other of the apostles. And of course, James, the Lord's brother, was not one of the 12 apostles. But the fact that Paul feels compelled to quickly put that in there, that he did see James, the Lord's brother, what's that tell you about the position that James has in comparison with the 12 apostles? I mean, he's not an apostle technically, but he's right up there with them. And he obviously is a leader in that church, leader among Jewish Christians. And that's what Paul indicates here. And then just one other passage here in Acts 21, you may recall that when Paul ends his third missionary journey and comes to Jerusalem, it is James who meets with Paul along with the other elders there, and he informs Paul of some false rumors about him, that Paul was teaching the Jewish Christians to not circumcise their children, that it was wrong for them to live the Jewish lifestyle. And that's not what Paul had been teaching. But James informs Paul that false rumor and helps Paul to try to correct that. So this is what you see in regard to James in the book of Acts. And just kind of a little bit of history that we know about him. And we don't know an awful lot, but we know from the biblical accounts that he was this leader. And especially his focus, his ministry was among Jews. If you look at the little epistle of Jude, well, this is written by another one of those half-brothers of Jesus, Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who are the called, beloved in God the Father and kept for Jesus Christ. So that's how Jude, or Judas, identified himself. He's the brother of James. Both of them, of course, half-brothers of Jesus. Might just show you this. Later in the second century, Hegesippus is quoted as saying this about James, that he had a reputation, even among the non-Christian Jews. He had a reputation for his virtue and his piety. He was tremendously well-respected among Jews there in the city for how dedicated he was to God. And then I also wanted to just show you this. This is the account in Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, that speaks about the death of James. Does anyone recall how James died? He was stoned to death. And this is what Josephus talks about in his Antiquities of the Jews. What he's talking about here would have taken place about AD 62. AD 62. In fact, that's right about the same time that Paul is in prison in Rome. Remember Acts 28? For a couple of years at least, Paul is there as a prisoner. Well, right toward the end of that two-year period, it's probably coinciding with the incident here with James' martyrdom. Josephus says this: Ananus thought that he now had a good opportunity, as Festus was now dead and Albinus was still on the road. So he assembled a council of judges and brought before it the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, whose name was James, together with some others. And having accused them as lawbreakers, he delivered them over to be stoned. Now, Josephus was not a Christian. He was a Jewish historian who was writing the history of the Jewish people for the benefit, especially of the Greco-Roman world, to show that the Jewish people had a noble history. Well, this incident in regard to the martyrdom of James was something that Josephus felt was important enough to put in his history. And he's talking about how Ananus, who was the Jewish high priest at that time, AD 62, since Festus, who's the Roman procurator, you recall Festus from the book of Acts? Okay. Well, okay, this is after Festus has died, and so there needs to be a replacement procurator, and that will be Albinus. But Josephus says that Albinus was still on the road. He hadn't yet come to Palestine yet. And so that meant that there wasn't the procurator who was overseeing the Jews. And you remember we even saw this in our Gospel of John study. What was Roman law in reference to the Jews and their judging their own criminals? What restriction did Rome put on them? They could render any judgment they wanted to, any punishment they wanted to according to their law, the law of Moses, but they couldn't execute somebody. That had to be administered by a Roman official, which is why Jesus had to be taken before Pilate. Well, here, Ananus has got a good opportunity because there's no procurator. There is no person in the role of Pilate who's the procurator. And so as a result of that, since things are in a state of disarray, it says he assembled a council of judges and brought before it the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, name was James, together with some others, having accused him as lawbreakers, he delivered them over to be stoned. And so this is... this is the life of this man. He started out as a man who was not believing that his half-brother Jesus was really the Messiah, but then Jesus appeared to him after his resurrection, and he became not only a believer, but a stalwart defender right there in the hot seat, right there in Jerusalem. And for years, he maintained his virtue and his piety and was helping those Jewish Christians and helping with the spread of Christianity at its most difficult center, where all the Jewish leaders were who were not wanting to accept Christianity. And ultimately, in AD 62, Ananus used that opportunity to have James and the others stoned. So it's really a very, very sad end to his life. But again, that's what we see with so many of the apostles. And of course, Jesus himself had said, if they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. And so eventually, James was willing to die for the brother that he earlier in life did not follow. So I think that's really a marvelous story for us. Comment or question about any of these things, any of the history of James that we've talked about. I just kind of wanted to give you a quick run through. Any comments or questions about any of that? All right. Have you seen this in the news in the last couple of years? Anyone know what that is? Well, that's an ossuary. What's an ossuary? It's a bone receptacle box that ancient Jews would use when the corpses of their loved ones would decay and they only had bones left. Well, they'd take those bones and have a second burial, rebury them in an ossuary, in a bone box. And this one made the news a couple of years ago because it came to light. It had been discovered many years before, but it kind of came to light because it's a complicated story, but the particular scholar was most involved with this. He said that he had not noticed the inscription, and he took it to the owner of it had not noticed the inscription, took it to a scholar to read the inscription, and that inscription right there in script that would match ancient Aramaic script said, "James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus." And so this, you know, just made all the newspapers and the news shows and all that, because if this was authentic, then that would sure appear to be the ossuary that would have held the bones of James, the James that we're talking about, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. And the whole issue was whether or not it really was authentic. Because it's not like this was discovered by archaeologists in situ, just, you know, right there in its place, but instead it was, you know, passed around on the antiquities market and then came to light. So very, very questionable circumstances. When it finally came to public light, a lot of people have said, "Oh, this has been proven to be authentic." And I even spoke on this a year or so ago because there's been a lot of attention given to it, and a lot of people were saying, "Oh, this is a, you know, the actual ossuary box of James." Well, the dust has finally settled. It's, well, that's not even really an accurate statement. The dust has settled to an extent. There's still some folks in the scholarly world trying to kick up dust about this, but I'll give you what the current general view is. There's not much question that the ossuary box itself does go back to the first century period. But most scholars who have examined this do not agree with the initial scholar's assessment. And they have determined, especially from looking at the patina, the oxidation on the lettering that would occur over a course of time, most scholars believe that though the ossuary goes back to the first century, the inscription on it is a forgery of recent period, that somebody got one of these ossuaries, and there are a lot of these ossuaries that would go back to that time period. And so what they think happened is that somebody got an ossuary and then forged that to try to make some big bucks. Which, unfortunately, that's not the first time that a forgery like this has happened. And there's a lot of deception, you know, that goes on. In fact, all the shenanigans that you see going on in archaeology in the Indiana Jones movies, now, that's fiction, but it's not too far over the top. Now, I don't mean these archaeologists wear fedoras and crack whips and swing from cliffs and all that, but some of the duplicitous stuff and the shady stuff and the illegal stuff and all that going on behind the scenes, unfortunately, that's not too far off the mark in this part of the world when it comes to antiquities. So I just, in fact, just recently I read an article in a paper that many of our brethren produce and write for. Many of you may get this paper. And it was really presenting this issue of the ossuary of James, really kind of leaning toward the view that it was authentic. You know, well, that's, again, it's not 100% sure one way or the other, but in all likelihood, it isn't. So you just need to realize that. So that's the reason why I'm bringing this up, just because so many people have heard about this. Any question about that? Yeah, Tony.
Has it been
wouldn't make any difference, except you'd go, hey, that's pretty neat, you know. And I do think it would be neat. I mean, I'd be excited about it if it were true, but you just have to, you know, not. There are plenty of authentic archaeological discoveries to get excited about, to say, ooh, isn't that neat, about, without having to just jump at everything that seems real, real cool. But as far as, like, faith and all that, no. I mean, there's nothing that would be changed one way or the other. Okay. Other comments or questions about this?
Okay.
Yeah. No. No, there were no bones. But it had been, the original owner said that he had it on his shelf along with about 100 ossuaries for years and years and years. And I don't remember where he said that he got it. Of course, some think he's the guy that forged it, you know, which I don't know. But a lot of people accuse him of being part of the shenanigans, but whatever. Other questions? All right, well, let's talk now about the recipients of James' letter. If you've got a letter, you've got not just the author, but you've got the audience, you've got the people to whom it's being sent. So I think we need to talk a little bit about who these people are as we begin to read this letter and study it. Again, when you just think about how he addresses this letter, James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. That terminology, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, what is that suggesting? Or where does that language come from? Anyone know? Well, the 12 tribes is obviously a reference to Jews. I mean, that's a Jewish expression. But this expression, 12 tribes who are dispersed. What if I told you that even before Christianity, that kind of terminology was used by Jews to refer to a particular segment of Jews? Who would I be thinking of? Now, you remember, as a result of both the Assyrian and the Babylonian captivities, that Jews there in Palestine were just dispersed throughout the ancient world, and their descendants continued to be dispersed. There was only a small remnant of Jews who returned with Zerubbabel and then Ezra and then Nehemiah to the promised land. Just a small remnant returned. And so just the vast majority of the Jewish population was still dispersed, scattered, is how you could render that word, throughout the ancient world. That's the reason, by the way, when you're studying the book of Acts, just about everywhere Paul travels, what does he find in every city? Just about every time there's a Jewish synagogue. Or if not a Jewish synagogue, there's at least a place of prayer there, that you have a small number of Jews there. So that's the reason why there are so many Jews throughout that Greco-Roman world. That's also the reason why you have so many Gentiles that the book of Acts refers to as God-fearers. Remember who God-fearers are? It almost seems like Luke uses that as a technical term for a particular kind of Gentile who believes in Yahweh, the God of the Jews. Cornelius, for example, Acts chapter 10, was a God-fearing Gentile. He may have come from a pagan background, but he was a worshiper of Yahweh, the God of the Jews. He had come to believe that Jewish God was the creator, was the true God. And why did you have so many pockets of God-fearers throughout the Greco-Roman world? Because of all these Jews that had been dispersed and were living in Jewish sections of these cities. And so as a result of that, you know, that's part of, I think, the fullness of times. I mean, that's what helped Christianity spread, not just to the Jewish world throughout the Greco-Roman area, but also to the Gentiles more readily throughout that area. So that terminology was something that terminology that Jews, even before the time of Jesus, would have used to refer to their Jewish countrymen who were still scattered throughout the diaspora regions, were scattered throughout the Greco-Roman world. Okay? And if you recall, in fact, does anyone recall our study of Isaiah that we had about a year ago? You remember what the prophets said would happen in the last days with all those Jews who were still in exile? Remember what the prophecies were? That when God's kingdom came, that he would gather together all of his exile people. And they would all be brought to Mount Zion. Just a remnant had returned, but in the last days, all of his people, all the seed of Abraham would be brought to Mount Zion. And so you'd have this great, great kingdom. So that's what Jews were anticipating. In the last days, when God's kingdom would come, that all of the Jews who were scattered and living as aliens throughout the Greco-Roman world, that they would be united there in this great, great kingdom of God. All right, well, that's the terminology that James is using. But when James uses this terminology, and when you read his epistle, it's very clear he's not just writing this to any Jews, he's writing it to Jewish Christians. Those are the people of God who are scattered and in exile, and the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. It's these Jewish Christians who are scattered away from the homeland. And so that's the terminology that James uses when he refers to the recipients of this letter. And I think it's probably helpful for us to think about the book of Acts. Remember how the book of Acts talks about the scattering of the early Christians? You remember the early chapters of Acts, you've got the kingdom beginning here in Jerusalem, day of Pentecost, and then the months that follow and the years that follow, the church is just growing, and you've got the initial 3,000, then you've got 5,000 plus people, and that doesn't even count women and children, and they're just growing daily. And what was the incident that the book of Acts says scattered those Jewish Christians? Yeah, when Stephen, a diaspora Jew, is martyred by the Jewish authorities there in this city, and then they begin this persecution of Christianity in general, and Acts chapter 8 says that all of those Christians in the city, they were all scattered abroad, dispersed abroad, except the apostles. Remember, Gamaliel's counsel was, don't attack the leaders. Don't make them martyrs. But all these new converts, they're the ones that got attacked. They're the ones that seemingly were the most vulnerable to persecution. And so they were attacked, and they just had to scatter for their lives. And if you recall, Acts talks about them scattering. And in fact, do any of you recall where they scattered to? According to Acts, a lot of them went north, yeah, through Samaria, up through Phoenicia. Some went to the island of Cyprus. And then some came all the way up into Syria, the area of Damascus. Capital city is Damascus. And so they all start here, and then they're just dispersed in this area here, these Jewish Christians. And all of that's taking place before the gospel ever starts to be taught to Gentiles. So at that early time, the church of Jesus is still a totally Jewish church in its ethnic makeup. And so now these Christians are scattered throughout those areas. And so James is now writing to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. It just sure seems that when he uses this language and when he writes this letter, he's writing to Jewish Christians. Not to Gentile Christians, but to Jewish Christians. And remember, James' work was always among Jews, always among Jewish Christians. You see that from Acts, you see it from what Paul says in Galatians. And the content of his letter I think as you read this letter, you'll see why I say this. Just the content of the letter, it just seems like these are Jewish Christians. Not even Jew-Gentile mixed, but Jewish Christians. One minor point, but he refers to their assembly as a synagogue. The actual Greek word that he uses is the Greek word synagoge, synagogue, which is a Jewish term. And there's no reference anywhere in this letter to Gentile issues. And surely you see from the book of Acts and from Paul's epistles that as the gospel began to spread to Gentiles, I mean immediately, what was the issue that Jewish Christians had when the gospel was spread to Gentiles? How can these Gentiles be part of our kingdom? It's a Jewish kingdom. So if these Gentiles are going to be part of the kingdom, they have to what? They got to be circumcised, which should make them Jews. So they're no longer Gentiles. And they've got to keep the law of Moses. Live as a Jew. That's what the Judaizers were teaching. That was just their assumption. And that issue just always emerged whenever the gospel went into Gentile quarters. Well, there's no reference at all to any Gentile issues in the book of James. So it's just incredible to me to think that this letter is addressed even in part to Gentile Christians, and there would be no reference at all to any Jew-Gentile issues or anything. It just seems like it is a completely Jewish audience, and probably not Palestinian Jews either, because he refers to them as those who are dispersed abroad. So again, that's terminology for those who have been dispersed, Jews who have been dispersed outside of Palestine. And again, here's the passage in Acts chapter 11 that I was referring to. So then, those who were scattered because of the persecution that occurred in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except to Jews alone. And I know that a lot of times we real quickly, want to start reading verse 20, because in verse 20 it says, there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Greeks also, preaching the Lord Jesus. Well, yes, some of these Jews who were dispersed, he says those from Cyprus, some from Cyprus and some from Cyrene, which is northern Africa, some of them, some of those Jewish Christians, they came to Antioch and began to preach the gospel to Gentiles, not just Jews. But does everyone see that Luke is very explicit early on? Those who were dispersed, and the vast majority of them in that earlier period, they were speaking the word to no one except to Jews alone. So what I want you to see is that in those early years, you've got Jewish Christians who are scattered in these areas, and you don't have Gentile Christians yet. Or maybe, as James is writing this letter, you've got maybe some up in Antioch who are, again, among those beginning to teach the Gentiles, but you just don't have Gentiles yet. Who are members of the church, at least not widely, so that this letter sure does appear to be written to Jewish Christians at a time when you don't have Gentiles living among them. And, it's not like Paul's letters, where he's writing most of the time to Jew-Gentile churches. In fact, mostly Gentile churches. So that's one reason why, I really think that probably this letter of James is one of the earliest of the New Testament epistles, and maybe even the very earliest. In fact, let me just talk with you about that. James died in AD 62. We know that from what Josephus says. And so this entire epistle was probably written very early. Seems to have been written before the Jerusalem Council of AD 49. That's where the Gentile issue became prominent. James makes no, and James was a prominent player in that Jerusalem conference of Acts chapter 15, but the letter of James makes no reference at all to any Gentile controversy or any kind of issue. So I think probably that just had not really affected these Jewish Christians to whom he's writing as yet. Whoops, didn't mean to go there. Don't look at that. You didn't see that. And a lot of the question, you know, about the... Well, this thing's going mind of its own. Stop that. The date is dependent upon whether James is correcting a misunderstanding about Paul's teaching on justification by faith. Some have suggested that maybe James, where he talks about that we're saved by works and not just by faith alone, that maybe he is trying to correct some misunderstanding that some had begun to get from Paul's teaching about justification by faith. That I think makes sense. In fact, I think that probably, though, was a misunderstanding that any Jew was going to have, since from a very early period it was being taught to them that we're saved not because we're Jews and not by works of the law of Moses, but by our faith in Jesus Christ. And James will emphasize in this epistle that what faith means is not just saying I believe, but it means putting it into practice, acting on it. And so I think that was, even from a very early period, an issue that these Jewish Christians needed to be corrected in. So anyway, those are just some initial comments about this letter. I know I've kind of lectured you there a lot more than I normally do. Comments, questions about any of this stuff? Tony.
When you see the idea of them misunderstanding, that kind of, you know, maybe mess you up a little bit, but we've seen in other books where Peter had made remarks to people he was writing to, and he knows that Paul's, you know, hard to understand sometimes.
Yeah.
So that would explain it.
Yeah, and again, I'm not even convinced that it's really that James is responding to misunderstandings about Paul himself, but just this whole teaching that, sure, Paul was the, you know, most well-known proponent of, but still, even among the Jewish Christians, they were having to be taught early on, we are justified by faith. It's not because we are Jews, not because of the law of Moses. That's why those other Jews out there among our countrymen who don't accept Jesus, that's why they're not in the kingdom. Because it's not simply being a Jew. It's having your faith in Jesus. But James is having to correct a misunderstanding. Well, what does that really necessitate in practical terms? Can you just say, I believe in Jesus, and then not act on it? That's what James is having to correct. So I think that then could mean this epistle is very early. Mickey? I'm not sure that it's exactly that early, but Acts 11, you know, the passage that I just showed you up here on the screen that talks about them being scattered. Keep in mind that's describing in one set of verses events that took place over a course of years. You know, this scattering didn't just happen, you know, like in a couple of weeks or something. You know, being scattered to Cyprus and Phoenicia and Samaria and Syria, and, you know, I mean, that takes, I think, quite a few years. So I'm not going to say it's exactly right in between those chapters 8 and 10, but, you know, but somewhere before the gospel is heavily obeyed by Gentiles. Sometime before, you've got just this real heavy influx of Gentiles, which really means before Paul's missionary journeys, or at least, you know, just as he's starting out. You know, still a very early period of time. So maybe AD 46, 47, you know, right in there maybe, you know, which is, you know, Acts chapter 12, those events there take place like AD 44, you know, So that kind of gives you, you know, maybe a frame of reference there. We aren't sure, and so I'm not trying to make some definite, you know, date here. But basically, folks, what this all boils down to is this. When you read this epistle, and all of you, by the way, are going to do that, right, by Sunday morning? Okay, pretty please. When you read it all the way through, just now think about what you are reading. You are reading a letter that James, the brother of Jesus, and this leader just on par with the apostles, is writing to Jewish Christians who have been scattered, they have been dispersed, and they obviously are already settled in their communities. He doesn't talk to them about persecution, really. Yes, he does talk about trials that they've been going through. But, I mean, he doesn't talk about some kind of formal persecution still afflicting them. So they've already been scattered, and they've already settled in their areas, and they're meeting in their worship assemblies, and you know, just daily life is going on. And so when you read this letter, you are reading James write to those Jewish Christians, and he's going to be writing to them about various issues and problems that he knows they need some instruction in. In really just putting Christianity now, well, really, that term Christian hadn't been used yet, probably, by the time James writes this. Putting discipleship, being a disciple of Jesus, putting that into practice in your life. What's that mean? And they're not under his purview now. They're not under the purview of the apostles. So they're kind of on their own, in a sense, and having to live the Christian life now in their respective assemblies. And he's instructing them about how they need to do that and just put the teachings of Jesus in practice. That's what you're reading. And what he tells those Jewish Christians, even though we've got a room full of Gentiles here, I think all of you are Gentiles, but what he's telling them is what's true of Christians. And what you will find out as you read this is that even though this was written to Jewish Christians 2,000 years ago, it is so applicable to you and me today, 2004, United States of America. And I think you just really benefit from reading this. So, we're going to dig into the text starting Sunday morning. But this was our introduction to all this. Okay? Thank you for your comments, folks.